Not for the first time, and sadly not for the last, we ask on this program what happens after the crisis. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 20th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Underneath all the finger-pointing and Monday morning quarterbacking over how and why Silicon Valley Bank and Signature failed, there is a fundamental question. Were these regulatory failures, or were they failures of supervision? As politicians and lobbyists and various and sundry interest groups take sides, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains the difference between the two, first of all, and why which kind of failures they were matters for what comes next.
Okay, who didn't do their job right? Danielle Zanzalari teaches economics at Seton Hall University and used to work at the Boston Fed. She puts it in a more academic way.
Was it a failure of regulators in not supervising this institution long before they failed? Or was it the fact that they were meeting the regulatory rules, but SVB perhaps needed tighter regulation? And so that's the question that people are asking.
A regulatory failure would mean we need better laws or rules to prevent this from happening again. To decide whether this was a regulatory or supervisory failure, it helps to know what bank supervisors do. Jim Cooper is the CEO of the Conference of State Bank Supervisors.
You evaluate the adequacy of the bank's capital, you evaluate the asset quality and their liquidity and their ability to manage things like credit risk, interest rate risk, those types of things.
Most of us don't really pay much attention to all this unless something goes wrong.
Right? If the supervisory side of things is doing things well, you would never hear about it.
Kathleen Hanley teaches finance at Lehigh University. She used to work as a senior economist at the Fed. Hanley says, unlike supervision,
you hear about the regulatory side because banks or other regulated entities often, you know, engage in media and lobbying activities that bring those regulatory activities to the broader public.
Whether this was a regulatory failure or a supervisory failure, or both, will determine how to move forward. Do we need tighter regulations on banks, more and better trained and empowered supervisors, or a bit of both? In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders didn't really see anything they didn't like, except maybe shares in First Republic Bank. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are two main interconnected stories in the economy this week. Banks is one. The Fed is the other. The central bank starts a two-day meeting on interest rates tomorrow. And you don't have to be an economist to know that this meeting is going to be a doozy. But we have called an economist to talk banks and the Fed and some other things. Nina Eyhackers at the University of Rhode Island. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Before we get to the Fed and the events of the last 10 days or so, give me your 30-second update on the state of this economy right now. What are you thinking?
We are going through some big wobbles, but the Federal Reserve is doing everything it can in tandem with other big central banks practically around the world to reassure banks in their respective countries that they will get them through the problems at hand.
So let me get you to that problems at hand thing. You saw the news over the weekend. I'm sure lots of people have seen it, that the Fed and a lot of other central banks, the Fed is going to expand to the benefit of other central banks, rather, dollar swaps availability. That is to say, the Federal Reserve is going to make dollars available to basically any central bank that wants it. That kind of smacks like 2008. And I wonder if people hearing that are going to go, oh, my goodness, are we there again? We're not there again. Let's just be clear about that, right?
I agree. I don't think we are there yet. Though central banks may appear to be acting heavy-handed in this response, what they seem to be demonstrating is an understanding that panics have escalated. And by transitioning to this huge response, they are doing what they can to bring things back under control.
Okay. So all of that said, let's teleport ourselves to Wednesday and Jay Powell stepping up to the microphones in the Federal Reserve building there on Constitution Avenue and saying, good afternoon, it's good to be here. And then having to walk a very delicate line, depending on what the Fed decides to do, whether raising rates or pausing. Talk to me about the Fed's communication challenge right now.
So the Fed, since the start of 2023, has been really in huge damage control mode about inflation. It has been raising rates over most of 2022 in order to curb borrowing, in order to curb spending. However, with all these banks in trouble, the Fed is simultaneously engaging in massive relief efforts, actively lending out billions of U.S. dollars to banks in order to keep them from collapsing. So these look like 180-degree difference. Mm-hmm. What I suspect the Fed is thinking about is to what degree the current financial panics will do the job that rate hikes have been doing. Banks are likely to dial back from lending in this moment. And in the process, that may decrease the need for the Fed to keep raising rates to the degree that it has.
Let's talk next steps in the banking situation that we have now. I talked to Dan Tarullo last week, the former chair of the Committee on Supervision and Regulation at the Fed, as you know. And he said, look, I think there's more regulation coming. I think we may see broader insurance there for deposits above and beyond $250,000. What do you think we're going to see?
I think it is a very bad look for bankers to lobby for deregulation and then fail, which is something that the head of SVB and Signature Bank had been a part of. I think that the Fed is coming under a lot of scrutiny for not drawing more attention to these underlying risks in the financial system overall. And I think that it really is not a good look when other parts of the Fed's strategy for cooling inflation have apparent impacts for homeowners that are trying to buy a house or for workers who may be at risk of losing their job, for banks that have opposed regulation to look as though they are getting a free pass in all of this.
Let me get you back to where we started, the wobbles that you see now. Do you suppose that this is a passing moment? Look, I understand this is a really tricky question, right? Especially when there's a microphone in your face. But do you suppose this is a passing moment, or is it the precipice possibly of deeper problems in the larger economy, not just banking?
I think that what it speaks to is a broader moment of uncertainty. And this was always a possible outcome when the Fed started targeting rate hikes. The desired outcome of increasing rates is to make it harder for entities to borrow, to discourage banks from lending. But that can create funding problems for the financial institutions themselves. I suspect we will continue to see banks come into trouble. But I really hope, I maintain faith that these central banks know enough about the recent past and even the farther past, if we look back to 2008 and 2009, to see the costs of not engaging in large action when it's called for.
Nina Ihacker is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Rhode Island. Professor, thanks for your time. I do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You think Switzerland and you think maybe chocolates and fine watches and banking. That is what you call a brand identity. The challenge for Swiss banking now, of course, is that its brand has taken something of a reputational hit with the UBS rescue this weekend of Credit Suisse. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes wondered where the brand that is Swiss banking goes from here.
Switzerland's reputation for safe, secret banking goes back to at least the First World War, when it became a hub of financial transactions with people in lots of countries, no matter what side they were on, says Princeton historian Harold James.
So the story is really intimately linked with the story of Swiss neutrality.
But the flip side of the word secret? Shady. Andrew Hilton's an economist and independent consultant based in the UK.
Swiss banks would take money from pretty much anywhere and would not ask too many questions about it.
And other countries didn't want their citizens shadily stashing money in Switzerland, points out Pace University economics professor Niso Abouaf, who used to work at Credit Suisse.
Because of pressure from both the European regulators and the U.S. regulators, Swiss banks stopped being a tax haven and they had to compete in other ways in the global marketplace.
So in the last couple decades, Swiss banks pivoted their brand, promising excellent wealth management, like a lot of American banks. But economist Andrew Hilton points out they had the advantage of not being American.
Lots of people don't view the Americans quite as positively as Americans do. You might want to put your money somewhere that isn't as susceptible to Washington's pressure.
Now the future of Swiss banking really hinges on the new UBS, which historian Harold James points out will have a balance sheet bigger than the whole Swiss GDP. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Money likes to be with other money, right?
I guess, yeah. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 382 today, 1 2/10%, 32,244. The NASDAQ gained 45 points, 0.4%, 11,675. The S&P 500 picked up 34 points, about 0.9%, 39.51. We heard from Stephanie Hughes just now about the sale of Credit Suisse to UBS. Investors seem to approve of that move. UBS stock jumped 3.3% today. Stocks in the big banks were a bit mixed today after the tumult of this past week. Tumult or tumult? You tell me. J.P. Morgan was up 1%. Bank of America fell 0.2%. Wells Fargo slid 0.7%. Today, shares of First Republic Bank out of San Francisco continued the plummet today, losing another 47%. That is after those 11 big banks swooped in last week to try to save the lender with $30 billion in cash deposits. There's talk, by the way, of more. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.48%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All the rain we've been having out here on the West Coast isn't going to do much for one of the most important sources of water we have out here, the Colorado River. And we have talked about how the seven states in the Colorado River Basin haven't been able to agree on a deal to save that river. But more than 30 tribal nations have a legal claim to the water in the Colorado, too, including a dozen whose water rights have never been officially quantified or settled. Today, the Navajo Nation argued in the Supreme Court that the government has a duty to fulfill its treaty obligations even as the water levels keep dropping. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has that one.
In 1908, the Supreme Court ruled that when the federal government created reservations, it also reserved enough water for tribal nations to sustain themselves. So why are some tribes still arguing their water rights in court?
It's a combination of racism and colonialism.
Andrew Curley is a professor of geography at the University of Arizona and a citizen of the Navajo Nation. He says despite that 1908 ruling, policymakers continued to exclude tribes while divvying up resources like the Colorado River.
The only way we could get the attention of the state governments is through litigation.
And that litigation is expensive, says attorney Heather Whiteman runs him, who helped settle her own tribe's water rights in 2010. The Crow tribe had to hire lawyers, hydrologists, lobbyists.
Very involved, very time consuming, and, you know, somewhat speculative because you can never tell just what a court is going to do, right?
Not all tribes can afford that. And without adequate water resources and infrastructure, tribal economies suffer, says Heather Tanana at the University of Utah, who's also Navajo.
Because of health costs, time spent collecting bottled water, you know, premature deaths, like there is a real significant cost.
Before the Supreme Court today, the federal government agreed the Navajo Nation's water right exists, but argued it doesn't have a duty to enforce the right. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
A story now about what happens when things go wrong. Not systemically wrong, not economy-breaking wrong, just a glitch. But a glitch in an industry that requires breathtaking precision. High-tech manufacturing is what we're talking about here. Semiconductors, for instance, have tolerances measured in nanometers. Lasers require crystals of incredible chemical purity. Inevitably, though, mistakes are made. And when that happens, one industry's trash becomes another industry's jewelry. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
At a mobile phone industry conference in Barcelona back in 2013, a representative of a New Hampshire-based company called GT Advanced Technologies is giving a demonstration to a reporter. He picks up a chunk of concrete and scrapes it ferociously across the screen of his iPhone.
And I'm going to start to, scratch away, right? And when I clear that away, you'll see that there's no damage to the screen itself.
GTAT had agreed to make sapphires for Apple, which was considering replacing the Gorilla Glass on its screens with the much harder material. Bob Sanders is a reporter at the New Hampshire Business Review who covered GTAT for more than a decade.
They needed to produce really big ones, bigger than they've ever done before, at higher temperatures than ever before.
Sapphires weighing hundreds of pounds, much larger and much purer than what's found in nature.
And they signed a contract to do this. Problem is that they couldn't.
They hadn't made sapphires before, just the furnaces used to make them. There were defects, there were cracks, and the enormous crystals called boules were useless. They piled up.
They call them a boule graveyard.
The company went bankrupt. Shareholders lost more than $1 billion. Litigation ensued. The giant sapphires disappeared.
We were asking around pretty actively to see if any of it had gotten out during the bankruptcy.
Stephen Challoner is co-founder of Angry Turtle Jewelry, based in Raleigh, North Carolina.
We were lucky enough to find one from a surplus warehouse somewhere in Oregon, I think. We had it shipped to us freight.
It weighed 500 pounds.
We had to take it apart with a concrete saw and with sledgehammers to get out the few clean areas. But once it's trimmed up, it cuts absolutely beautiful stones.
They glitter and shine, and Challoner sells them on Etsy and Instagram now.
Our business is centered around repurposing industrial materials, which are grown for science, medicine, and research, and reusing them as gemstones.
They range from a few dollars to a few $1,000s for a single stone. In his workshop, Challoner holds a pink ruby larger than a golf ball and slices through it with a diamond saw. The stones he cuts were originally intended for lasers, medical imaging machines, cell phones, even fusion reactors. This ruby was left over from the 1980s Strategic Defense Initiative, also known as Star Wars.
Sourcing this stuff is basically a full-time job. We have to do a lot of cold calls, send a lot of emails, and find crystal growers or crystal processors or researchers who are willing to part with their scrap.
They are not always willing. Sometimes scrap is remelted and recycled. Sometimes the crystal's composition is top secret. Some of the scientific crystals Chandler manages to get his hands on contain rare earth elements. Some of them change color. Some of them actually glow in the dark.
I think my favorite is LUAG, lutetium aluminum garnet. It is used to detect invisible radiation, and it has an insane neon green color. It glows like nobody's business.
One of those rough stones went to Eric Bardawil, owner of House of Silas, to facet into a gem.
So he sent it to me. I opened the box. It's just glowing. You know, I texted him, what is this stuff? Is it safe? Are you going to kill me if I cut it?
Bardawil cut it, posted the video on TikTok. It got 1.2 million views.
People went crazy. And then for the next month, I think all I did was sell LUAG gemstones.
They go for a few hundred to more than $1,000. Bardawil thinks the popularity of these industrial stones is in part because of a shift in the diamond market. People are warming up to lab-grown diamonds for wedding rings, and that's spilled over into acceptance for synthetic colored stones, especially if they have a good backstory, like failed industrial products or fusion generator parts.
We'll have to kind of see whether it fizzles out or what, you know, so I have faith.
For now, it's not just the crystals that are glowing, sales are bright too. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The word of the moment in banking right now, it's one of several words, to be honest. That word is liquidity. I would argue it is the word, though, because underlying all the talk of bailouts and contagion, liquidity, literally how much ready cash banks can get their hands on should depositors ask for theirs back, liquidity is the be-all and end-all. And bankers around the country have been getting a whole lot of questions about their liquidity of late, so Marketplace's Justin Ho called some of them up.
People stowed a lot of cash in banks early in the pandemic. They needed to put their government relief aid somewhere. But Dominic Miartin, CEO of Optus Bank in South Carolina, says those days of liquidity pouring in are over.
Well, we grew largely during that period. Since that time, that liquidity has been gradually trickling out of the system.
Part of the issue, he says, is that some of his competitors started offering higher yields after the Federal Reserve started raising interest rates. Now that Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank have failed, Miartin says his bank's concerned that the gradual trickle could pick up.
Our board and team was very concerned about the situation and definitely spoke in favor of us raising additional liquidity, even though we may not need it today.
Miartin says that's because Optus Bank is making a lot of loans. It needs to hang on to its customers' deposits. So it's followed its competition and increased the interest it pays on certain deposits.
And we may have to offer up a rate, frankly, that a year ago would be unconscionable. We would not even consider that rate. But today, you know, we may have to get a little bit more aggressive.
Miartin says there hasn't been an uptick in withdrawals within the last week. But people could start pulling their money if they get worried about the banking system more generally, says Julie Hill, a law professor at the University of Alabama.
When they're faced with concerns, they think that the easier thing to do is to withdraw their money and move it rather than do a bunch of research to see if their bank is better situated than others.
Hill says that's why government regulators have been stepping in to offer banks more liquidity. Just over a week ago, the Federal Reserve created the Bank Term Funding Program, which offers one-year loans to banks that need the money.
They don't want people to watch on the news and see one or two or three banks failing and think, oh my goodness, my money isn't safe in banks. I need to go take it out and put it under my mattress or whatever.
Or go put it in another bigger bank. The thinking being?
Money likes to be with other money, right? Money likes to be where it's safe. And it's safe at JP Morgan. It's safe at, you know, Citibank. It's safe at Bank of America.
That's Marisa Baradaran, a law professor at UC Irvine. She says history has shown that the government's willing to step in and save banks if it considers them systemically important.
I mean, the system itself rewards, I think, the larger banks because it has the most protections for when they fail because of the too big to fail problem.
There's a good reason to leave money in smaller banks, says Robert James II, CEO of Carver Financial Corporation. It's a minority-owned company with community banks in Alabama and Georgia.
If a company is doing business in the Savannah region, for example, and they want to make sure that a portion of their dollars are impacting the Savannah community, a big employer should make a deposit with our institution.
James says the last few years have demonstrated that smaller banks can step up in times of crisis.
We saw that during the pandemic when our banks were the ones that were able to step in and help people that needed PPP loans or needed other assistance and needed to get to a person that they could talk to.
James says the banks have been reaching out to potential and current clients over the past week to reassure them.
We have the highest capital ratio that we've ever enjoyed in the history of our institution, which is almost 100 years old. Past dues on our loan portfolio are at historic lows.
And his bank's liquidity, he says, is high. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which you gotta know the whole picture. Yes, Amazon said today it's going to lay off another 9,000 people. Yes, that is in addition to the 18,000 job cuts the company announced a couple of months ago. Here, though, is the context. In the before times, Amazon employed about 800,000 people. At the end of 2021, about 1.6 million people. Yes, 27,000 people are going to be out of work, but headlines are only part of the story. All right, here's your moment of economic context, although I guess maybe that Amazon item was more contexty than this one is, right? Anyway, here goes. Bitcoin today topped $28,000 per. It's had quite a run, Bitcoin has, since SVB went under. Still and although, here is the question. Repeat it with me. Would you take your paycheck? Don't repeat that. Repeat this. Would you take your paycheck in crypto? Our daily production team includes Olivia Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.